Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
A bed beside the hearth in a thatched cottage kitchen. A pint in the snug of Comiskey's Dominic Street. My mother's autumn windfall apple tart drowned in cream. The squelch of wellies in a bog puddle. The 4,000-year-old leathery bog bodies in spiral snugs in the museum. Cloney Cavan man's magnificent mohawk. The settle beds and dowry chests in Collins Barracks Museum. The snuff bottles in the Chester Beatty. Donkeys. A kitchen dresser with plates and cups, the top shelves displaying the seldom-used good delf, scraggled in dust. The warmth of milk straight from the cow. The first sup of cold cider on a hot day. The first chip after the last sup of cider. Sunset over Cabra West. Miniature trains worming around miniature tracks in Clonakilty's model railway village. The life-size Sligo train mawing through the countryside. The tinny ding of the Lewis bell. Bashing the double buggy down the steps of Broadstone Park. The drinkers on a nearby bench rushing to help. Can you manage, love? The dip of the boat at the landing pier on Skellig Michael. The eerie groan of the island's puffins. Gur cake from Clark's Bakery in Cabra. A Saw Doctor's song belted out on the radio. A 300-guest Belmullet wedding with no end to the jiving. Francis Bacon's studio in the Hugh Lane Gallery. A chaos of paint tubs and brushes. Halloween bangers and fireworks starting mid-August in Dublin 7. Young lads dragging bonfire pallets with such dogged diligence it seems harsh when the guards confiscate them. Wind turbines replacing Bellacoric's old chimney on the turn for Eris. The boggy horizon spelling home. Bays and coves etched into the coastline. Beaches with just cows for company. Cliffs that will give you the wobbles. The basking shark circling under the boat near Valentia. Its ancestor hanging from the dead zoo ceiling. The women at the GPO feeding the hungry. Decency undimmed by the queues. The gazebos, pergolas, pavilions and kiosks in city parks. Phoenix Park gate lodges like witches' cottages. Blessington Basin frozen in winter, the swans confused, the ducks fed up. The benches at the basin where patients from the Mater are wheeled for a smoke. And men on electric scooters conduct cash-only transactions. The smell of old books in Marsh's library. The cages for readers to stop any thieving. A cheese and onion crisp sandwich on white buttered bread. A snack box on a no-cooking day. A 99 on Dunleary Pier. Tiny islands on Connemara lakes. Little more than shrub clumps. Glamping for ducks. The trawl of light from Eagle Island Lighthouse. One sweep, two sweeps, three. Cleary's clock. The dart to Bray. Use the elbows to get the sea view seats. A stony beach paradise of dodgems, slot machines and candy floss. Match day in Croke Park. Horse with roaring hope of hearing the green and red of Mayo on the tannoy. A skinning wind through the railings on the Halfpenny Bridge. Gargoyles on the Glimmerman. Bog cotton, cowslips, sheep's bit and clover. Heather, foxgloves, bluebells and gorse. The magazine fort in the Phoenix Park. A setting for a spy novel. Boxty. The hacked-off sea stack at Downpatrick Head. The toilets in the National Library. Mosaic floors and armchaired opulence. The Lego model in its lobby, a library within a library. The maze at Rusborough House. The mini-maze in the Ivy Gardens. The man in the supermarket buying a flagon of cider at 10:34 a.m. Shaky hands paying exact change. The kindness of the Polish woman at the till. An impromptu dance-off between Dubs and New Yorkers at the portal. Hotel buffet breakfasts. None of your cooked fresh-to-order nonsense. Lay it all out there and let's get at it. dodging scudding forklifts at the Smithfield fruit markets, sliding down the scree at the peak of the Sugarloaf, freewheeling down the hills of Inishmore on rented bikes, my cycling rustier than the pedals. The blowhole at Dunamo, the wormhole. The hungry tree gobbling up the bench in King's Inns Park. The kitsch secrecy of the Freemasons' Grand Lodge, a walk-in Dan Brown novel. Era signs around the coast, neutrality in white stone. The ruins beneath the glass floor in the Anger Street Lidl. Dizzy shopping, clutching the trolley for balance. GAA player nicknames, Colm Gooch Cooper, Seamus Cheddar Plunkett, Shawnee Telly Tobin. The Gresham Vault in Mount Jerome Cemetery, with its bell on a chain for the person scared of being buried alive. The pint glass on Brendan Behan's gravestone in Glasnevin Cemetery. The midsummer bonfire on Tory Island. The rag tree at the Botanic Gardens. The secret holy well under Trinity College. The reluctance to build on a fairy fort, fearing of misfortune befalling. And my children's imaginary world, Fairyland, where marshmallow clouds rain candy drops and everybody has a toadstool home.
A warm breeze of a passing van belted into my body as I crossed the road. Just as the swell passed, I saw a young woman sitting in front of me on the pathway. There was a soft angst etched across her alabaster skin, and her bony frame was hunched. She was probably only about 20, but looked at least 30, and the youthful hope in her presence arrested me, even though her sparkle was dimmed, and seemed to gently twitch as each one of multiple thoughts flashed through her head. I said to her, "I don't have any change, but would you like a cup of tea?" She answered in a beautifully clear, clear accent with the tones and quality of a 10-year-old child, "Can I have a Diet Coke, please?" Her accent was as clear as her radiant face, and she had about the same amount of cracks in her voice that she had in her complexion. "Would you like a sandwich?" I answered. She said, "No, I'll have a coffee with four sugars. Can you get me any skins?" Once I was in sight, I had to glide past the sticky out spokes of a fold-up bike, which was being held by an agitated, rocking, sweaty man. A mother was shaking a buggy, reluctantly inspecting a bulging, crinkly Paw Patrol magazine as her child was making a case for her to buy it. The long queue was groaning. There was a lot of huffing and loud puffing about someone who'd wandered in off the street. I turned to look at who they were objecting to. I saw the back of a stoic, majestic woman in a grubby cardigan who was insistently and serenely making her case to the shop staff. Her delicate hands swished to and fro, and her long bony piano fingers gracefully punctuated whatever point she was taking her time to make. Tied back from the front of her head was a high ponytail, and the rest of her long grey hair was streaming down. It hadn't been brushed, but it had maybe been washed about a week ago. Because of the way her hair fell around her shoulders, my eyes were drawn right down to her trousers. They had a loose leg, and though they'd gone out of shape, I knew that she felt that they were still good enough to wear. The vertical lines went the whole way down the trousers, and when she was readying herself, she had pulled up her elasticated waist to right up above her hips. You could see underneath the trace of a blouse, and a tiny little hill of flesh on one side of her hips, just a little bit higher than the little hill on the other side. You couldn't fully see the seam of the trousers going in between her legs at the back, but it was a little too tight and crooked at the same time. There was something about her gait from behind that told me she was very much at ease with taking control, holding the reins, and that she'd always been like this. I let my mind wander into her life. Though I was transfixed by her aura, I pulled my eyes to above her head, where I saw three hostile faces of tall staff members looming over her. It was as if they were speaking in slow motion to a ghost from the past, even though her core was so alive. The frosty atmosphere surrounding her ethereality rapidly became sinister. Her time was done in this moment. Suddenly, she was bustled away, forcefully escorted out. Her soft whimper slowly morphed into a squirm, a long sustained pitch, rising and falling and turning into an angry cat whine. The shop manager broke away from the pack and shouted, "Next!" signalling to the heaving queue for the self-service kiosk. The woman's long primal howl paused only for her to take a breath, and her gait had transformed into that of a caged animal. While she was being restrained, one of the staff glanced to another and smirked. He laughed, but he wasn't laughing nervously or sympathetically. His eyes were gleeful and inviting so that she would respond some more. And he wanted more of her reaction. He reached his hand into his pocket and tried to get his phone out as if to video her. But he stopped himself. The trolley that she had wheeled into the shop had been toppled to the ground and a parcel had been flung out onto the floor. It had been neatly wrapped with white paper and there was beautiful handwriting on it. Now strewn on a busy, grimy shop floor, I wondered what precious item it contained and where it was supposed to be going. And I wondered what else she had skillfully packed into her trolley. Over the next few minutes, as dozens more shoppers entered and left, obscuring the commotion, behind the bustle, the back of her appeared again. Her gait was hunched, and she was tiny. I couldn't help myself. I burst out and ran to her. I squared my shoulders and I took her by the hand. Her tiny, bony hand.
One of my favourite photographs of me and my dad was taken on my wedding day, the camera close up on our faces, standing together at the entrance to the small Honan Chapel in University College Cork. We are just inside the door, smiling at each other. The light of the midsummer sun all around and behind us, he in his suit and me in my veil, we glow. We're smiling because we have noticed something no one else has seen. Beneath our feet on the mosaic floor, a circle depicting signs of the zodiac marks the start of the River of Life, which traces a tiled path to the altar of this Catholic church. We are smiling because we have noticed we are standing side by side on our own star signs, Sagittarius and Capricorn. A good omen, perhaps. I have loved this glorious floor and this building since my student days in Cork. The sun lies at the centre of the zodiac, where
where the ground has cracked along a line that appears to split it in half. The photo was taken 20 years ago. Last year I went back. Abandoned at the back of the church, a pink polka dot umbrella. Weddings still go on here, sometimes three a day. My marriage didn't last. 10.5 years after I crossed that sunny threshold and walked up the river of life into the stained glass lit darkness, the union cracked and split. 4 years later, we were divorced. 4 years after that, I was researching the work of the artist Imogen Stewart when I recalled vaguely that beneath the seats of the oak-carved chairs where my then-husband-to-be and I had sat near the altar, the maker of those chairs, Imogen Stewart, had left a note. I return on the day of my once wedding anniversary. There's a tour guide outside the gate. I linger as he repeats facts I already know about this place. The chapel was built in 1915, consecrated in 1916. Decorative elements inside include stained glass by Harry Clark, the mosaic floor by Ludwig Oppenheimer Limited, and a hand-carved altar and chairs by Stewart. I know this because I worked as a guide as I earned my degree, and the Honan was the finale highlight of the UCC tour every time. Inside, I take a seat. Imogen's altar shows the gospel saints Matthew, Mark, Luke and John as stoical, dutiful minions, their names carved into the scrolls held in their flattened palms. Their chins jut and shoulders hunch as if to squish each of them tighter into their deep carved niche. A man enters and falls asleep in the front pew, the soft whistle of his sighs barely disturbing the cool stone-built space. I do not want to disturb him by moving to the top of the aisle, so I wait. Three women walk in talking loudly. "My mum and dad got married here," says one. "Wow," says another, impressed. Their chat awakens the man, and when they leave, he leaves too. Silence. In front of the altar, I kneel on the floor, reaching blind into the gap between wood and tile, pressing click on my phone to capture what's underneath. Stark in the light of the camera flash, a handwritten note reads, "The groom's chair and kneeler are carved in oak. They are angular, masculine in shape. The chair back is based on an evergreen tree. The tree symbolizes the life in God's law. It stands for holiness, eternity, and everlasting salvation." These two humble, unassuming chairs are low and beautiful in their simplicity. Under the second, a note reads, "The bride's chair and kneeler are carved in oak. The shapes are soft and mostly curved, feminine. The chair back is based on the rainbow, which stands for the covenant which God made between him and man. The rainbow is also the symbol for peace and reconciliation." Each is signed Imogen, 1987. I sit again in the bride's chair. It's been 2 decades. The curve fits with the curve of my back. The seat feels solid and true. On the ground before me, a mosaic heron is about to soar. Beneath my feet, a stag. The groom's chair is inexplicably cold and feels the wrong shape, offering a hard line to the base of my spine. Imogen Stewart passed away in March 2024, aged 96. For most of her career, her themes and patrons were ecclesiastical. But I have always felt, more than anything, that her work is about love. In 1973, she also got divorced and became a single parent. In 2023, she wrote, "Today I am 95 years old. Although I no longer have the strength to carve larger pieces, wood remains my favourite medium. I will always love the sound of carving and the smell of wood. Turning a commission into something unusual or surprising, this is what continues to inspire my work." In the handmade embrace of her bride's chair, I am reminded that her art also tells and holds quiet stories about power, resilience, and grace. From the cool silence of the chapel, I walk back out into the sun.
Thank you. When I was growing up in Churchtown, we lived on a busy road with lots of traffic. There was nobody to play with. So I spent a lot of time in my own imagination, writing poems and talking to myself. I still spend a lot of time like this. At school, I read Evan Boland and fell in love with her images, her language, and her insistence. I was enchanted when my mother told me one day at the kitchen table that Boland lived in Dundrum, just a mile down the road, and she would come into the bank where my mom worked. That was the moment I understood that poets are real people who cash checks, run errands, and live in houses. I live in a rented house in Kiantfort, Dublin 8, an area of deep significance during the Easter Rising. Battles were fought and lost on this small hill overlooking the city. It was also one of the first social housing projects of the Free State. Its 100-year-old bricks and fences are remnants of our beginnings, our shared resistance, independence, and hope. These houses are a testament to an Ireland that looked after people, provided secure homes, allowed us to imagine new lives for ourselves. I live with the Easter Rising ghosts in my head as I write and move around this neighbourhood, which is home to many poets and artists. I have made books about Kiantfort, in English and in Irish. I have given walking tours of the streets. The house I live in is the only one in Ireland that has felt like home. This week, after 4 years of making my work here, I have been given an eviction notice. Before Kiantfort, I lived in a series of flats. Among them, one with no central heating, moth-eaten carpets, and such pernicious mould that we couldn't keep our clothes in the wardrobe. One year, the only effective heater in the flat broke and stayed broken for the whole 6 months of winter. That coincided with a large family of mice coming to live with us. When I called an exterminator, he was so bothered by our living situation that he called the landowner to tell him that the conditions were unacceptable. The landowner did not hire this man to exterminate the mice. Instead, he asked us if we were feeding them. Once it was in my head that Boland stood in her garden at the foot of the Dublin Mountains, as I wrote poems in my childhood bedroom, I believed that I too could make a life for myself as a poet. But at 40 years old, I'm not sure I can anymore, at least not in Ireland. I think about the house where I grew up and the house Boland lived in, and I feel very far away from ever owning a place like that in Dublin. As Boland often talked about, being a poet and a woman in Ireland is not easy. We have to fight for everything we get. I gave years of my life to the repeal movement, bringing me both joy and considerable stress. I have always believed that Ireland can be a place of empowerment and ambition for women and for everyone. But we are not empowered. Because of housing and so many other barriers, we are kept in perpetual adolescence, given pocket money and told to pretend. 5 years ago, after losing my mother to cancer, I suffered with chronic migraines and was referred for an MRI. I am still on a public waiting list for the scan. I cannot continue to live this fake adult life in Dublin. It is literally bad for my health. I may as well be back in the garden in Churchtown, talking to myself in a Fisher Price kitchen. The reason that Boland was so important to me was because she lived down the road in a house with her family. She did the dishes, she went on school runs, and she wrote and published poems. Real activities that require real support. No magic here, Boland writes in her poem, Ode to Suburbia. Sometimes it might seem like poetry is magic, that we are visited by a muse, and the words leap onto the page like the elves and the shoemaker. Really, what we do is make things. We labour, we construct, we push at ideas, and we try to bring those to life. We don't make things from thin air. This week, when we got evicted, I wished I could. I wished there was more magic in suburbia.
Ten minutes before the visit, I was hoovering ants. An infestation had appeared from behind a skirting board in the kitchen. Though my preference was to move them to a more suitable location, I'd no idea how to do that, and anyway, there wasn't time. The curator who was coming to see my work arrived, and we left the kitchen to sit with our coffees outside. I could see the ants regathering, taking advantage. We looked at things in the studio. I didn't say much. Hopefully the work would speak for itself. On some pretext, I left the studio to check on things in the kitchen. I thought of Louis Bunuel's film Un Chien Andalou and the grasping hand crawling with ants. I envisaged a plague. There are several postcards on my studio wall. They feel important, though I rarely look at them. One shows a painting by Fra Angelico, The Annunciation, a panel painting from the collection of the Prado Museum in Madrid. In the delicate portico where Mary and the angel Gabriel meet, the blue of the vaulted ceiling is patterned with gold stars. It looks like a painting by Richard Wright, as though the British artist, travelling backwards in time, has made a site-specific work in preparation for the miraculous event. Like the fresco painters of old, Wright paints directly onto the surface of things, as though reversing radiance. On two ceilings of Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum, he painted 47,000 black stars. Painting is an attitude toward touch, Wright says, the concrete point between the senses and the seeing world. Immersed in the sight of his work, the painter makes the world with his seeing hands. In Fra Angelico's painting, Mary's hands are crossed over her breast. Copying her gesture, the angel's hands cover the bodice of his pink tunic. The hands of God, appearing at the top of the panel, send down the Holy Spirit in a shaft of golden light. Wright claims that touch can soften the boundary between inner and outer worlds. As he paints, he says, the veil between this world and the eternal world is permeated. His return to the 14th century, a journey I've imagined on his behalf, may not be entirely fanciful. Bunuel's film, Un Chien Andalou, also moves between different times and locations. The most famous cut, the moon bisected by a cloud followed by the slicing of an eyeball, has the persuasive logic of a dream. When Bunuel wasn't making films, he was making martinis. Occasionally, these activities overlapped. Everything should be refrigerated at least a day in advance, he advises, including the gin, glasses, and shaker. He's ambivalent about adding vermouth. In his 1972 film, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, as the drink is being mixed, the camera leaves the room rather than witness this dubious operation. If vermouth is necessary, Bunuel suggests, it should be transferred to the mixture using only the most delicate of methods, preferably conveyed by a single ray of sunlight. Hitting the bottle of vermouth, the ray of light should penetrate the glass like an immaculate conception, piercing the surface but leaving it unbroken. In the film, the camera returns to the gathering, an ambassador's soiree, where the chauffeur has also been invited. The humble driver downs his drink in a single gulp. The ambassador, played by the reliably deadpan Fernando Rey, sips carefully from his cone-shaped glass. No system, he says, can give the masses the proper social graces. An hour passed, and the visiting curator left with a promise to return. In the kitchen, the invasion had grown to include larger creatures, called aelits, I later discover. These winged ants are encouraged out into the open by teams of busy workers. Finding their way outside, the breeze lifts a little and the ants are launched, zigzagging into the sky.
On this morning's programme, you heard Irish Treasures by Katrina Lally, Woman by Julie Feeney, Take a Seat by Christine Leach, No Magic Here by Julie Morrissey, and The Visit by John Graham. The music on this morning's programme began with Les Barricades Mysteriosus, composed by François Couperin, performed by Max Richter on harpsichord. Then we had Preludes, Opus 11 to 21 Andante in B-flat major, composed by Alexander Scriabin, performed by Marta Dejanova on piano. Then we had Disc Prepped 1, performed by Aphex Twin, written by Richard D. James. And finally, Science versus Romance by Rilo Kiley. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer of this morning's programme is Cleanany Onloon. You can listen back to the programme on the RTE Radio app and at rte.ie/radio1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.